What's up, everybody? Saturday, early evening for some folks. It's still late afternoon for me. But we're doing a show because Carlos and I just witnessed a tremendous heavyweight boxing fight with Anthony Joshua and Daniel Dubois. But Carlos, long time no chat. I thought this was a perfect opportunity for us to get back together because of the nice little early fight at Wembley Stadium and some big, you know, this is a big result coming out of the fight, which kind of sets the tables for the heavyweight division over the next probably the next year or so. But how are you doing?
I'm doing good. I'm doing good. Aren't you glad that I told you that this fight was only $20?
Yes, very much so. I was like, first of all, I'm pretty aware of Anthony Joshua because he's got such tremendous popularity, and he's going to be one of those guys in boxing history who maybe just never reached their potential, even though he's an absolute success. From a draw perspective, he was near the top of the food chain in the heavyweight division. There were just better guys than him, and that may just be the story of Anthony Joshua. But from a drawing perspective, this guy is still a monster, which is why I don't really think this Anthony Joshua thing is going to end, because there's just so much value in his name. We'll get to that and what all that means, but let's not bury the lead here. Daniel Dubois knocks Anthony Joshua out fifth round in one of the best fights I've seen in quite a long time. Nothing but action. It wasn't Hagler Hearns, but what is Hagler Hearns? Like, this is kind of the next best thing. Just two big guys throwing big shots, and Dubois kind of getting the upper hand early, knocking Joshua down early, and Joshua's fighting defensive, you know, semi-defensively because he was rocked for the rest of the way. It was just awesome action.
Yeah, and it really began like in the middle of, really in the first half of the first round, where Dubois just landed that big right hand that, you know, it just kind of staggered Joshua, and Joshua never really recovered, not because it hurt him that badly, but because Dubois never gave him a chance to recover. Like, from the opening bell, Dubois just charged right at him from the start and just started bombarding him with shots. And I was looking at the stats earlier, which, by the way, it's not the, if you look at the stats of the fight, it's, first of all, it's not CompuBox. It's something different that the zone is doing, but like the number of shots that Dubois was landing was almost like 2-1. And it felt like closer to like 5-1 with how much Dubois was basically swarming Joshua throughout the opening get-go. But like, you know, I was telling you right as we got, right before we got on the air, just reading this on Boxer, Joshua down four times, first, third, fourth, fifth round. Like, it's just unbelievable how good Dubois looked tonight. It was, you know, and I don't think like Joshua looked like terrible or anything. It was just a case of Dubois got the drew first blood.
Yep.
And he just never let up.
Yep.
It was just simple as that.
It was interesting because I was trying to listen to the broadcast and really try and figure out what they were thinking, because Joshua comes in heavy favorite and the entire promotion of this fight is, this is the best Joshua we have ever seen. And I even asked you that during the fight. I said, is this really the best Joshua, or do they just want us to believe that? Because the story of the last several years of Joshua's career is, he needs to fix some things, and when he does, he's got all the tools, and he's going to be a better version of himself. Like, I feel like this is the same conversation, you know, that we had, or maybe you and Robert had, or a lot of people had after the what's the big heavyweight Mexican guy who knocked him out?
Andy Ruiz.
Andy Ruiz. When he got knocked out by Andy Ruiz, now that was more of a surprise than this fight, obviously, but kind of the same thing, which is, you know, is this guy going to be the best? Deontay Wilder, that fight is gone, probably. I'm guessing, because Wilder is over the hill himself. Mm-hmm. But he still has big fights. I just don't know if boxing people think that he has a legitimate chance at beating the top guys anymore.
I mean, not anymore, in my opinion. And, I mean, heading into the fight, I mean, Joshua, in my opinion, this was like for the last, like, I don't know, when did he beat, when was the Autovolleying? The Autovolleying fight was not that long. It was only 10 months ago. For the last 10 months, Joshua looked really good because the problem with Joshua, well, one, like skill set wise, he has a pretty good skill set as a heavyweight. Not the best, but what complemented his skill set was the fact that he was physically just this Adonis looking guy with this otherworldly physique. But since I thought that this was, he was Kenyan with the most amount of momentum since the Klitschko fight. But even if you go back to the Klitschko fight, that was a fight that it was one of the fights where Joshua, even though he won and dropped Klitschko a couple of times, it was one of those fights that like it took something out of him because Klitschko battered him around at times during that fight. And you saw that also just come to fruition the first Andy Ruiz fight. And just mentally, to me, it was more of a mental block that Joshua was dealing for years. And it looked like since like last December that it was done, that he finally got over it. He looked fantastic against Autovolleying. You know, the Francis Ngannou fight, that was a wash. I mean, that we all knew how that was going to end. That was not.
Yes.
You can't really draw anything out of that fight. But just even looking back to Autovolleying, he was, you know, he looked great. He was staying active. He was fighting. That was, I think, like his third fight in like 8-9 months. He was doing everything right to sort of bounce back from the Usyk loss, which, you know, I don't think there was anything necessarily wrong with Joshua coming into those Usyk fights. Usyk was just a better fighter. And obviously, you can tell blatantly that the broadcast was hyping up Joshua to be the guy to fight for the winner of Usyk versus Fury 2, which obviously not going to happen anymore.
I mean, just the, you know, Usyk businessman, Fury businessman, in their heart of hearts, they had to be rooting for Joshua to win this fight. Now, Dubois is probably maybe even a harder opponent for them and now has less name value. So the capability to draw the maximum audience for a Joshua fight, like that was salivating everybody, Eddie Hearn as well. And that's the part of boxing that, you know, we'll see if this will change, because I really want to get your opinion on this, which is, you wait for the right time and the right money. And this is Mayweather and Pacquiao, you know, sort of 2009. Everyone was just dying for this fight. And then they put it off and put it off and put it off. And people will say, well, they waited too long. And if you look at the business of that fight, they did not wait too long because they made way more money than they would have if they were younger and, you know, better fighters. It would have been a better fight. But when it came to the business of that fight, they waited about the perfect amount of time. But now we have when you have Saudi Arabia involved, and Saudi Arabia is just like, whatever, like, come sign with us and we're going to throw bags of money at you to make sure that these fights happen. And in this case, like you said, $20 versus the $80 or whatever that people would have had to spend for the Canelo fight last week, which we'll also talk about in a little bit. The business has changed, it seems like. And if you are a boxer today, you may not have to kind of hold out for the crazy money, because the money being that much bigger than it has been in the past, there's no reason to leverage. Like, I'm looking at Terrence Crawford, and it's very clear that Terrence Crawford wants Canelo. Is the money out there for either guy to put that fight on, or do you just wait and wait and wait and wait? What if Saudi Arabia comes in and is like, we're going to give these guys as much money as possible? Now, promoters and matchmakers and all that, the differences in that area could screw things up politically, but like, there is a possibility for that fight to happen if Saudi Arabia was to get involved. If Saudi Arabia was not getting involved, does that fight have a chance to happen?
No, I don't think there's a chance that a Canelo Crawford fight, I mean, if Saudi Arabia is not involved throwing the amount of money that they're throwing at them, I think there's no chance. I mean, it's really more so just a money fight. Crawford, I understand. I mean, Crawford's, both of these guys' legacies are set. I mean, Crawford and Canelo are going to go down as first ballot Hall of Famers. No, yeah. No doubt about that. And I mean, clearly these promoters are also willing to play nice because they are now, because the money is just right there for the take. I mean, how many times before Saudi Arabia, how many times have you seen a show co-promoted by Eddie Hearn and Frank Warren that wasn't a result of like a purse bid or anything of the sort? It was unbelievably rare. That's why, you know, when Billy Joe Saunders and Demetrius Andrade fought each other a few years ago, no one cared about the fight itself. No one really cared about the fight. They cared about the fact that that Frank Warren and Eddie Hearn somehow managed to put their differences aside and do a show together. And ultimately, and now Saudi Arabia, we had that 5 versus 5 card that they did a while back that they got the Tonight Show. Saudi Arabia just putting all this money at them. And I mean, it's, first of all, and I'm just going to, I think it's pretty clear, obviously, what the game is for Saudi Arabia, why they're spending so much money with, not just the boxing, but with all these sports. We all know what the deal is. I don't think we need to get too deep into that, but in reality, but
you're talking about the sports washing that
yes. yeah. For anyone who may not have been caught on to what I was saying. Yes. I'm referring to the sports washing, but the deal with boxing is now obviously with all these fights coming together as a result. I mean, we got better BFB vaults coming together because of Saudi Arabia. Hell, it's now an undisputed title fight that originally was never going to be undisputed because the WBC was not going to sanction it. But then Saudi Arabia comes in with all the money and they're like, eh, you know, we're willing to put aside our thoughts and feelings on the war in Ukraine just for that Saudi Arabia money. So, I mean, now with Dubois kind of being that front man, that front runner to fight the winner of Usyk versus Fury, there's a lot of intrigue in either fight, in my opinion. With, and I was telling you this before we go on, with Usyk, there's a perfect build to that fight.
Mm-hmm.
The first fight last year, Usyk was down early in the fights, and Dubois had a fantastic start. Then he throws a borderline shot at the belt at Usyk. Usyk goes down. It was a 50-50, depending how you interpret it, 50-50 whether or not it was low blow or a legitimate knockdown. Ref called it a low blow, and then Usyk got back up. He stops Dubois. But had it been called a knockdown, Usyk would have lost that fight. He would not have been able. You could have counted 20, and he would not have been able to get back up. With Fury, the interesting thing is that this is basically a in-house fight because both of these guys are promoted by Frank Warren. And Fury, some people who follow Fury for a very long time knows he speaks very highly of Jared Anderson, mm-hmm. this American prospect, and so like this guy's gonna be a world heavyweight champion one day. But speaking for as the next great big American heavyweight. But then on the other side, he speaks very, very highly of Daniel Dubois as this guy who's going to be, given his age and in pure raw physical attributes, he's going to be the guy for the division when, Fury and Usyk eventually hang it up. So if Fury ends up beating Usyk in the rematch and there is no rubber match, Fury versus Dubois would also do monster numbers in the UK, and they could very easily do that at Wembley and could very easily do that same crowd that we just saw tonight. I don't know what the number was. I think it was 96,000. I think that was the number.
That's what I heard on the broadcast, but
let's wait until the turnstile numbers kind of come.
We'll figure out what the gate is and
let's hold off until before Dubois tattoos the attendance number on his somewhere in his body.
Good call out. Good callback to some pro wrestling there. I just wanted to shout out Big Leo because he was the only one I saw go on record as saying that Dubois was winning this fight before it started. You had predicted Joshua in a stoppage in 10. And I think on the broadcast, it was 80-20. For Joshua, I did a quick poll on the Fight Game Media Twitter, if you guys want to follow that, at Fight Game Media. And it was, I think it was like 72-28 or something for Joshua. So Dubois was not given a great chance to win the fight. And some of that is just because of what I mentioned before, is Joshua's insane popularity and his big, giant name. I did notice on Dubois' record, he has lost twice. You mentioned the Usyk one. And then he also lost in 2020 against Joe Joyce.
Yep, it was the Joe Joyce fight. It was done, and it was during the very early days of the pandemic, where no one was attending boxing fights. So he just did the studio show with no one in attendance, and that was quite an interesting fight, because Joe Joyce, it was the bill. Like, had this been like pre-pandemic, this crowd, it wouldn't have done 96,000 in Wembley, or it would not have sold out like one of these 70, 80, 90,000 seat stadium shows. But Joyce versus Dubois would have sold basically any other type of arena / small stadium in the UK, because it was the two biggest prospects in the UK at heavyweight, undefeated. And it was a very, very interesting clash of styles. Joyce, the older Olympic decorated, highly skilled guy. When then you had Dubois, who was this prized athlete, like piece of prized specimen, could like may not have a ton of experience because he started in boxing very late. But you see his physical attribute. You saw him just like, oh my god, like this guy's like unbelievable. And then Joyce really just dominated that fight. Joe Joyce was, I think, for like 8-9 rounds or something, he just jabbed at Dubois' right eye and broke his orbital bone until the fight was stopped. And I think this is one of those things that I love about boxing, especially UK boxing. The attitude is that a loss doesn't really define you, and you're able to bounce back and be a big star and be a contender. And look at Joshua. Joshua's lost three times, and in all three of those losses, he did not look good at all. Mm-hmm. And he still managed to bounce back and be a world title contender. And Dubois was able to parlay the losses and what he learned in the Joyce fight, not letting his opponent get the upper hand early, and in the Usyk fight, making sure that if you hurt your opponent, you make sure that your opponent stays down and not let your foot off the gas pedal. And I think this is a combination of what he learned in those two losses and staying active in the last 9 months. People don't realize Dubois has been really putting together one of the best resumes in the heavyweight division. After the Usyk loss, he fought 4 months later, less than 4 months later, beat Jarrell Miller. And then earlier this summer, he goes out and beats Filip Hrgović to win the IBM. I think at the time, the title that the world title he has right now was the interim title, but he went and stops him. And Dubois right now, probably even more than Usyk, has the most amount of momentum going for him in the entire heavyweight division.
Yes. So let's just quickly go through the five rounds. We can go through the entire fight. And I just want to get your thoughts on some of the action as it happened. So round one, right out of the gate, Dubois gets to the middle before Joshua. He's very eager. He's aggressive. Lands the first big shot. And immediately Joshua has that look on his face of like, oh man, this is not how I wanted this fight to start. Joshua's trying to set up the jab smartly. That's, you know, he's got the jab and the right hand behind the jab. And the thing that I noticed immediately is these guys are so big that they actually made the ring look small.
Yes.
Like just giant humans, like the boxing ring. You know, you always think about, when I think about size of ring, I always go back to Leonard and Hagler, because Leonard gave up a lot of the A-side stuff to get get stuff like a bigger ring, right? I don't remember if gloves were, you know, whatever involved, but some of it was like Leonard's like, okay, the bigger ring's going to help me. But then you see this ring and I'm like, oh my gosh, it looks like these guys are already fighting in a phone booth because they're so big. So he throws an overhand right that drops Joshua. And at this point, I thought the fight was going to be over. The referee allowed Joshua to kind of get his bearings back. And then as he gets back up, he is immediately saved by the bell. What did you think of Dubois' start and just his strategy and what he wanted to do early on?
Wayfair's big sale is back, and better than ever. Get ready for Way Day. For 3 days only, October 5th through October 7th, save up to 80% off on everything home. From furniture and holiday decor to cookware and hosting essentials, this is the sale to stock up for the season ahead. Oh, and did we mention everything ships free? And flash deals launch all Way Day long? Don't miss Wayfair's big sale. Get up to 80% off starting October 5th at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
I thought, right, as you kind of pointed out, Joshua was trying to establish the jab early on. And I thought to myself, you know, he's starting off fast. And I think, like, Dubois was thinking, like, no, I've been down this road before where I had a bigger, longer guy try to start the fight early with the jab. I'm not going to allow that to happen again because I have a broken orbital bone that tells me I shouldn't let him do that. And so the start was really good. I think one thing I was a little bit surprised was how kind of exposed Joshua's chin was. Mm-hmm. Even from the very beginning, Joshua's chin, a lot of times throughout this fight, even before he got hurt, he kind of left it a little bit more exposed. And it was a little bit surprising that it would kind of allow it to, he was kind of like, I don't want to say lax is the right word, but it wasn't. But I don't think he really understood just how hard of a puncher Dubois is, or figured that Dubois wasn't going to come out swinging as hard as he did and as fast as he did, because Joshua was basically fighting off the back foot from the opening bell. Like, there was, I can count, I don't know, there were what, 15, 20 seconds in the entire fight where Joshua wasn't fighting on the back foot. And
when he got knocked out, like, that was one of the only times at the end of the fight when he's like, oh, I can finally advance and I can actually go for it. And then he left.
And that was like, what, 5 seconds?
Yeah.
That whole sequence was like, we'll get to it. But like, the ending sequence was like not even 10 seconds long. It was just so incredible just how fast everything went. And really, the referee in this fight, Marcus McDonald, boy, he had an off night. The third round, oh my God, that was...
I almost thought for a second, and we'll talk about it in a second, but basically Joshua touches both gloves to the ground, which...
Very clearly.
Been a knockdown, and then he said... I just thought he was like, I don't even want to try to get between these two guys. Like, they were swinging so hard, it was almost like a business decision the referee made, because he clearly saw it, because he takes a step forward and then he kind of throws his hands up. And I was like, oh, like, he realizes what happened and he just does, you know, whatever the decision was, he clearly saw it. It's not like he missed it. He just decided he was not going to separate.
And that's, and also, like, it wasn't always like that. Like, it was after the first time where he started acting like that, because if you remember, like, the first round, he was like, in fact, like, I would say, like, almost a little bit too harsh when addressing Dubois, because the first two times they both kind of clinched up, the referee just essentially, they separated them, and he really was giving Dubois the business. And then, like, after that first round, it was kind of like, it was a completely different ref almost.
Second round, Dubois comes right out. He's smelling blood. He knows that he's got an opportunity to finish the fight. Joshua's holding on. He's still got that look on his face like, oh, man, this is not great. And Dubois nearly drops him with a jab. Joshua fell backwards, and if he had not had the ropes to lean on, I think he would have actually gone down from the jab. He was just off-centered and off-balanced. Joshua got his bearings back a little bit towards the end of the round. Dubois clearly in charge and looked very comfortable in there. Did you think that it was possible that Dubois was going to finish in that second round?
I wouldn't say no. I would say no, because I thought that, you know, Dubois was maybe going to try to break him down just a little bit more, because we know how we know Joshua is capable of putting up a resilient and valiant effort even when he's down. I mean, go back to that Klitschko fight I mentioned. If, you know, Joshua knocked Klitschko down, Klitschko then knocks him down, and then Joshua was able to come back. So we know he's capable of turning fights around on a dime. But I think it kind of looked like the game plan from the very beginning was to just go nonstop pressure on Joshua, not necessarily go for the kill from the opening round, but basically try to set him up maybe for like a mid fight stop, not early, but more so it's kind of a mid fight stop. But I think Dubois was able to just keep the pressure ongoing, not necessarily putting the foot off the gas pedal, but definitely second round. You know, if you were a Joshua backer, you really didn't feel still that confident because Joshua, he still looked like he was still a little bit out of it from that first round knockdown. I mean, let's be honest. If that first round had lasted maybe 20 more seconds, it's a good chance Dubois would have knocked AJ out.
Yeah, yeah. Round three, Joshua throws a big right hand that misses, and Dubois makes him pay with a huge shot to the body. Joshua, at this point, he's like throwing punches and just expecting to get hammered. Like he's kind of ducking after he punches. So he's not even able to put on all the heat because of he just knows that that fire is coming back at him. Dubois puts him back against the rope to the left hand. And this is where the gloves touch, like you said, and should have been ruled a knockdown. And Joshua is like almost falling through the ropes.
Yeah.
And I think he took an uppercut just kind of without being able to defend himself, but then gets saved by the bell once again at the end of the round.
Well, save, I mean, knowing what we know now for the rest of the fight, I don't know if saved by the bell would have been an apt phrase to use. If anything, the punishment just continued from that point on, or would have been more merciful to just stop it right there.
It would have been better if he just stopped that the third round.
it was still such a weird sequence because the way, I mean, if you have not seen the fight, he basically, Joshua was up against the ropes, his legs stretched out, and both of his hands were basically on the ground. It wasn't like, you know, we've seen cases where like the gloves touch the canvas, but it's like one of those instances where like it was moving and it's like just barely grazed it, but technically that should still be counted a knockdown. It wasn't in this case. It just like both fists were just clearly planted. It lasted like half a second, but it was very clear and long enough to know like, oh yeah, no, anybody, everyone saw that it should have been called a knockdown. And not like the referee had his back turned. He clearly saw he was to AJ's left, and I really don't know. But it, like, actually, the funny thing was like, even the guy who with the microphone that starts to count whenever someone gets knocked out, he started counting, was already at like I think like at 3 or 4 before the referee was like, no, there wasn't a knockdown.
that was a little weird where they're counting, but the referee is not counting as well. So round four, Dubois puts him down again, but I think it looked like a slip. Joshua gets back up, goes down again. That one was ruled a slip. Mm-hmm. And then Dubois hits Joshua low, which gives Joshua some time to kind of calm down a little bit and go back to the corner and take a breather. But then Dubois comes back and he's just swinging for the fences. Like, punches that Joshua was able to block are just still pushing him all around the ring. Then Joshua lands an uppercut that I was like, if he can land more of those shots, there's a chance that he can kind of get himself back into this fight, because Dubois is throwing such hard punches and he's just aggressively swinging that he did get a little bit tired at the end of the fourth, that I thought. And I was like, if Joshua can land this punch again at some point, maybe he can get himself back into the fight. What did you think about at the end of round four?
No, I kind of saw it the same way as you did. Joshua, I mean, he was still clearly hurt. He was nowhere near 100%, but he was basically fighting on heart alone. And You know, we've seen Dubois kind of have these fast starts and just kind of fizzle out towards the end. But it was still, but by that point, Joshua, I mean, technically he still had a shot at turning things around, but it was taking so much punishment. It was dropped so many times. Even the times where, you know, you would think like, oh, well, he slipped. I mean, they were preceded by him getting knocked off the socks plenty of times. Number of times, I mean, how many times did it feel like Joshua was going to just roll out of the ring by one of Dubois' punches? There were multiple times in that fourth round. It looked like almost like if he wasn't careful, he was going to get out of the ring. And I mean, that would have been real bad. So I thought that by that point, you know, that was kind of the point where I thought this is starting to get close. Well, since the end of the third, I thought this is really starting to get close to the very end. I wasn't sure by that, but when it was going to happen, I wasn't sure if Joshua was going to do enough to kind of turn things around. But I mean, it was going to take an eternity for Joshua to recover. If Dubois had let him recover, he would not have recovered until like maybe the seventh, eighth round. That's how much punishment he had taken by the time we were done with the fourth.
So round five comes and I sort of thought, I was like, oh, Joshua may have a little bit more confidence here because of how the fourth round ended. So he actually knocks Dubois backwards with a right hand. And as he is advancing, he's looking to finish himself. I think he probably feels like this is my only chance to finish this fight. I have the advantage. Now let's put him out. But he made a fatal mistake, I thought. And look, when you are as dazed and as hurt, possibly concussed as Joshua is, I do not blame him. Like he is in bad shape at this point. But he knows that the uppercut is the money shot for him. Mm-hmm. And he has Dubois reeling back toward the corner, and he fails to set up the uppercut. He just kind of throws it. Dubois sees it coming. Like he knows, he's got to know that this is what Joshua wants to do. Sees it coming, throws a right hand, and this is the one that put Joshua's lights out. There, I thought he was going to be waved off, but they did do the 10 count. He was kind of getting up, trying to get up, did not make the 10 count. Fight is over. One of the best fights I think that we'll see all year long.
The way Joshua was kind of trying to get back up, it almost looked like Clubber Lang when he got knocked out by Rocky in Rocky 3, and was just trying to squirm his way back up, and it just couldn't. Like, by the time it got to like, oh, that's an awesome shirt. Where'd you get that shirt?
Oh, gosh. I forget the company. I'll send you the link because they send me a lot of stuff.
That's a cool shirt.
They must have the Rocky license because they have a lot of Rocky stuff. For those on listening on the podcast, I just showed Carlos the shirt I was wearing, which is the Rocky boxing tour shirt. So it's a photo of Rocky from Rocky 3, which Carlos was mentioning, which is why I showed it to him.
Yeah, and the thing, and going back to the fight, I mean, the shot that put AJ away, that wasn't even the hardest shot he threw in the fight. It was like a short, quick right hand to the chin. It was excellently timed, well placed, and you know that was, you know, by the time when he hit that, and I saw the replay, I thought that was not the hardest shot Dubois threw in the entire fight. AJ was that tired, he was that gone, like that. Uppercut he threw that kind of just for like 2 seconds kind of turned things around. It really was more of a red herring because Joshua was still completely out of it. I mean, he was still going off of pure will and instinct by that point. But because he was already hurt so much, he wasn't fighting the way that he probably should have fought at that instant.
Yeah.
You know, when he pushed Dubois back, that was not the time for him to try to push things around. He should have tried to either keep his distance off, get himself time to recover. That was the fifth round, was not the time to try to go for the kill right then and there. And it was similar to the first Andy Ruiz fight, mm-hmm. where, you know, Joshua tried to get a little bit too eager and he paid the price. And in that very similar fashion, where Ruiz kind of caught Joshua upstairs when Joshua had a momentary lapse in judgment. And, you know, Dubois, but what else can be said? Dubois looked fantastic. This was by far the best performance of his career. And right now, you cannot do any other fight other than Dubois versus the winner, Usyk Fury. And you can easily do that at Wembley, no matter who it is, and it's going to do, and it's going to fill the entire stadium.
What if Usyk wins again? Mm-hmm. Because another insanely huge fight would be Fury and Joshua. Could that happen?
It could. Theoretically, it could. I'm wondering, you know, if Fury loses, I don't know if Fury would even want to fight again. Because by that point, there really isn't anything else for him left to do.
Don't you think he is pretty confident that he could beat Joshua, though?
Oh, no. Yeah. It's not a question of whether or not he feels like he can beat Joshua. I think, and honestly, right now, I mean, obviously, we'll see how Fury looks, but I can very easily see myself picking Fury to beat Joshua.
Yeah.
And you know, for a while in between, you know, the Ruiz fights and the Usyk fight, I would have picked Fury to beat Anthony Joshua somewhat handily. But the thing is like, I don't know if the motivation would be there for Fury, because, you know, Fury is a guy that is almost entirely driven by what motivates him. And right now, you know, what motivates him is to try to get Usyk in the rematch and become world heavyweight champion again. But if he doesn't beat Usyk, you know, there really isn't, I don't know. I don't know if Fury would want to keep fighting, because I don't know if he has just enough in the gas tank to even do that fight. Now, even if Fury loses and lays an egg in there, I still think Fury versus Joshua would still do big business, not gigantic business. And hell, I think you can still even do Wembley. Like, if you give Joshua a nice, quick fight, like we're almost in October now.
Yeah.
I mean, if you put Joshua in a fight, you know, late winter, like February, March, April, May, as a bounce back fight. And then, you know, you have to kind of get a little bit of momentum and then just build towards a fight in the summer against Fury. But you can do that. You can do that and still do big business, because these are still the two biggest names and the two biggest stars in British boxing right now. But, you know, it's not going to do big business, or at least what it could potentially do. And that's
what is Deontay Wilder doing right now? The last time I know, he fought in that series show that they did, but the last time I actually saw him was on Traitors season 2, which is a NBC reality TV show that's actually pretty successful. Like, what is he at this point? Completely washed, somewhat washed.
I mean, I want to say completely washed, but I will say somewhat washed. I think right now, Wilder, if he keeps on fighting, you know, I think it'll be something where, you know, Deontay Wilder still has a name. But I mean, it was pretty obvious by the Zhele Zhang fight, Wilder just doesn't have it anymore.
Yeah.
Now, whether that be due to age, because I mean, let's remember, Wilder's almost 40. I think he's like 38 right now. Wilder's almost 40. And
38, you're right. He'll be 39 in a month, almost exactly.
Wilder, it's the same as I said about Fury. Wilder's a guy that is really, that really operates on what motivates him. At this point, I mean, you can't really expect to try to restart your career for a world title run, for a chance to try to challenge for a world title. It's not going to happen. So I really don't see Wilder. I mean, if Wilder wants to fight Fury, or I'm sorry, if he loses, or Joshua, I mean, he could, but it's just going to be one of those fights where you're just kind of left wondering, like, why are we watching this now when these guys are at their lowest point of their career? And that's for Joshua, that's unfortunately the big question mark of his career.
Yeah.
Is the fact that you had right there the two of the biggest fights in modern heavyweight history, and you whiffed on both of them and none of them got made.
Yep.
It was, you know, Fury versus Joshua in their prime would have been the biggest British boxing fight, I think, in history. Or at least, you know, the biggest British heavyweight boxing fight in history. And with Wilder, you had, I mean, the makings of an unbelievable build between two of the two biggest stars in the heavyweight division since Lennox Lewis. I mean, for as much as for as big as Klitschko in his career was, I mean, Klitschko was really a huge star in Europe, but he was never a big star in the U.S. I mean, he wasn't a guy that drew gigantic numbers the very few times he fought in the United States. But I mean, Joshua, he first time bringing him to the U.S. sells out Madison Square Garden. Wilder, big star the entire world over. And just never saw those two fight. And I almost kind of don't want to watch Wilder Joshua now, because like all we'd be doing is just wondering, man, what could have been had we seen these two fight.
It could very much look like this fight, though, because both of them have incredible power and their defense is not, you know, for Joshua, it almost seems like the big shot, you know, that just kind of sets him off and he doesn't have that chin or the legs after that happens. But like Wilder, Wilder's all about the big shot and getting hit with the big shot these days. And just to put more into context of what you were saying. So Wilder was undefeated and had that one draw with Tyson Fury in that great fight, which is now almost 6 years ago, which is crazy. He got his 42nd win. I saw this fight in the movie theaters, actually, with my now wife when we were dating, when he beat Luis Ortiz. Mm-hmm. And then he had the two rematches with Fury, which he lost both of them. And then he beat Hellenius, and then he lost to Parker and Zhang. So since he was undefeated and got his 42nd win, he is 1-4, which is
with three of them being knockouts and bad knockouts.
Yeah,
like bad knockouts and stoppages. Like the Zhang Wong looked pretty bad. Fury just completely destroyed him in the rematch. Like it was like almost to the point where it was like a career altering beatdown in that second fight. And Fury just kind of finished the job in the trilogy.
Mm-hmm. All right, let's move along here, because I do want to ask Carlos a couple of other things. So last week we had Canelo and Berlanga. I was covering the UFC show, which was at the Sphere, UFC 306 for F4W Online. So I was not able to watch that fight. And I got some early returns that, oh my gosh, Canelo might knock this guy out. And then, but I was not surprised by the end to see that it went all the way to the scorecards. Sounds like it was a very easy win for Canelo. Where do we go with the biggest star in boxing? Because what it seems like to me is it's kind of like what happened with Mayweather, in that people were just sort of tired of paying for the same thing over and over and over. And while Canelo, again, still the biggest star in the U.S., I think what you're paying for is not what we saw today. You're paying for him, you know, winning the majority of the rounds, not really putting himself in harm's way too much. And, you know, when the opportunity is there, he's going to throw hard shots and go for the knockout. But if it's not there, he's not going to force it, because he's still that good of a boxer and can win, you know, without having to knock people out. What do you think about where we are today with Canelo and where we're going with him as the top star in boxing?
You know, it's almost like a shame, because I mean, right now we're just kind of dancing around the fact that there is a David Benavidez sized elephant in the room that Canelo really isn't addressing. And, you know, the Edgar Berlanga fight, everyone knew what was going to happen. Berlanga really had no shot of winning. Yeah. And I still am of the belief only reason Berlanga got this fight is because he's Puerto Rican. Because Mexico versus Puerto Rican on Mexican Independence Day weekend. I mean, that's the easiest sell in the world. You don't even have to try. You don't have to try very hard. And the business for big fights of that type of caliber. I mean, it's always going to do really good numbers, especially which I think was, you know, Dave was mentioning on the show, like it's incredible how you had two mega shows of two different sports in the same city at the same time draw the amount of gate that both of those guys, those fights did. I think it was Dave said like 17 million for Canelo and like 22 million for the Sphere fights.
And at the same time in the same city.
Yeah. And almost like almost two completely different audiences by that point, because that really was, I mean, Canelo fights, especially in at this time of year, really more so for the hardcore fans, like at least locally. I mean, it's a big spectacle for even casual fans to even tune in on pay-per-view. But yeah, no, the, you know, it really was, you know, kind of a shame that we're wasting a Canelo fight at this stage of his career. He doesn't have many years left. And Canelo against Berlanga just really didn't do it to me. One, I think that if you really wanted to put Berlanga in, it was way too soon. You know, they could have done a better job building Berlanga up to at least make the fight even bigger. But with Canelo, you know, it is kind of now starting to get to the point where we are wondering, you know, if Benavidez will never be in the cards, and I have a sneaking suspicion that that's the case, that Canelo versus Benavidez will never happen, then what's next? I mean, we kind of talked a little bit very early on in the show, what about Terrence Crawford and whether or not that can happen, you know? And I don't remember if I mentioned this to you like a little while back, but I don't know if I can see a scenario where Canelo does end up signing with Saudi Arabia and make it something to where, you know, you have a two-fight build. You wait until the winner of the vacant IBF title that Canelo was stripped off, wait for whoever the new champion is going to be, which is going to take place next month, I think in Germany. And whoever wins that fight, you know, feed him to Canelo for the Saudi Arabia card. And then after that, have Crawford make the Crawford fight, which is, you know, I can see that being the plan, because I don't see William Skull or Vladimir Shishkin beating Canelo. I think it would be just as dominant of just as one-sided a fight as we saw with Edgar Berlanga. But if not, you know, but if it doesn't go with the Saudi Arabia route, you know, there really isn't that many more names PBC can throw at Canelo Alvarez and put him on these Amazon Prime pay-per-view shows. There really is not that many. I mean, David Morrell, who's an unbeaten Cuban fighter who is a really, really good fighter, and I think he would be a decent test. He's a very excellent offensive fighter who's been fast-tracked to being a world title contender early in his career. That's a possibility. Trying to think who else would be, because there's really not that many guys who
Does he want to avenge the Bivol fight?
Only if Bivol wins. I don't think there's anything in it for Canelo Alvarez if Bivol loses to Better BF. Which is very much possible. It's very much possible that that Better BF can beat Dimitri Bivol. Personally, I think right now I'm probably leaning towards Bivol, but I don't feel confident in that pick at all. Just because Better BF is offensively, he's an absolute beast. But you do wonder, you know, Better BF's age and the injury history that he's currently piling up right now, you wonder if that's going to catch up to him right now. But, you know, if Bivol loses, you know, I don't see that fight, because like the only reason that Canelo would entertain a Bivol rematch is Canelo moving up in weight to to fight, to be basically be an undisputed champion at 175, which, you know, I mean, that's tempting, but, you know, Better BF wins. I don't see Canelo fighting Better BF. I don't, unless Better BF wins, but looks not great to the point that where Canelo can think, you know, I think I can still take him on. I don't think, you know, his power may not be quite what it once was, but we're keeping it to 168 pounds. I don't know. I mean, Christian Mbili is a very interesting idea. He's a fighter coming out of Canada who top rank is really now starting to put their chips in with trying to showcase him and seeing like, okay, maybe we can try to force something where Mbili becomes a mandatory title fight for Canelo Alvarez. I know some people are, you know, getting a little high on Diego Pacheco, but I still think he's, you know, I still think Pacheco is still not ready yet. So we're not at the point where we're throwing these names, but it's like, yeah, but, you know, maybe it's not there yet. And, you know, I don't want to say that we're at the point where almost like Mayweather fighting Andre Berto. We're not quite there yet.
That would be a bad place to be, I think, for everybody.
By the way, if anybody doesn't realize like how, you know, what level I'm referring to, like go to Floyd Mayweather's Wikipedia and then go look at the pay-per-view bouts section. And it's, you know, Andre Berto was Floyd's last fight, you know, before Connor, but it was immediately after Pacquiao. Look at the steep decline. Like, it wasn't gradual. It was, you had Pacquiao Mayweather was at the top of the world's tallest cliff. Berto was at the absolute bottom in terms of like the business it did. It was like, actually, I don't even know. Do you even know how many pay-per-view buys that did?
I just remember it being really disappointing, which is not surprising.
It was like less than, I think, I don't want to jinx myself, but it was definitely under a million. I don't remember if it was under half a million.
Yeah, I seem to remember it being like really, really disappointing based on what Floyd was even doing. Because remember, at the end there, who's the guy that Floyd fought twice?
400,000, 400,000 buys.
Who did Floyd fight right before that? Because he had two.
No, that was Pacquiao.
And then before Pacquiao,
The two Marquez Maidana fights.
Those are the fights that I was thinking of. Because Maidana was great at one point, like he very entertaining and stuff. But you know, he was not on Floyd's level, and so we sort of figured Floyd was gonna neutralize him, and that's what happened. Though Maidana fought pretty well. I remember that first fight. But so is there a chance where Canelo's like, what is the next challenge? I'll give up 10 pounds. I'll go up to 190 and fight whoever the cruiserweight champion is.
You know, I can very much see that because there are some names at cruiserweight that I think Canelo can beat. I don't think Gilberto Ramirez is, well, assuming Gilberto Ramirez beats his next opponent. But, you know, I can see like late in his career, which seems to be the trend for once great fighters at 168, kind of just saying, you know what, screw it, I'll just go to cruiserweight. Who cares? You know, I can see Gilberto Ramirez like making this like a really excited, like a big all Mexican war that you can just like, I don't know, do it in Estadio Azteca and sell out 120,000 people. And I guess you can do that. That's assuming Gilberto Ramirez beats Chris Bell and Smith later this year, which it's doubtful. It's a very interesting fight. It's actually a really good fight at cruiserweight, but I can see, depending on how the belts look in half a year from now, I would not put it past Canelo to decide, screw it, I'll go to cruiserweight. Hell, you know what? I think there's guys at that sham division, Bridgerweight. Canelo's like, I can go to Bridgerweight at like 200 flat and take the belt. It's like, it's I don't want to get too much into the Bridgeway thing, but yeah, no. Canelo, I mean, there are ways for Canelo you can try to make up challenges as you go, just trying to like freshen things up a little and just be a, I guess at the better point, he'd be a five division champion, right? He's he won 154, 160, 168, 175 when he beat Kovalev. So yeah, it would be five division champion.
Bridgerweight is between 200, which is the cruiserweight limit, and 224 pounds.
So
that's
yeah. So,
awesome.
Yeah. And no one recognizes that division. The WBC is just like, hey, let's make a new weight class. And the WBA is like, we might want to do that. And everyone was like, no, Bridgerweight is for guys at cruiserweight who just don't have it anymore, but they're too small for heavyweight. And the funny thing is, Oleksandr Usyk is the best heavyweight in the world. He's not even a fighter weight-wise where he's past Bridgerweight. He can literally go to fight Bridgerweight as he is right now, which kind of goes to show, like, you know, that like that's like taking candy from the babe for anyone who even is remotely good at the top level.
Yeah, yeah. All right, let's look at some of the fights for the rest of the year. You talked about Beterbiev and Bivol, which is in about 3 weeks, and that is on ESPN Plus. Is that going to be on just ESPN Plus, or is there going to be a pay-per-view component to that? Do you know?
I'm trying to remember. Here's the problem. The way they have it is a little weird. So on ESPN Plus, no pay-per-view. You are getting the main event.
And that's okay.
That's it. You're getting
good.
You're only getting the main event for free. I think if you want to watch the entire card, it's going to be on the Zone pay-per-view, which I'm going to be on if they do it at $20, the undercard, it's actually pretty good. Chris Eubank Jr. I think it's a cool main event. Fabio Wardley versus Frazier Clark in a rematch for the British heavyweight title, which is, if you haven't seen that first fight, I think the first fight is on Peacock because they, I believe that's where it was. It was an unbelievable fight. It was an incredible fight between these two guys that it was like one of the best fights of the year, in my opinion. And they're going to run it back in Saudi Arabia. That's going to be the, and I think it ended in a draw, by the way. So they're going to basically run it back, and that's going to be fantastic. J.O. Pitaya versus Jack Macy. That's for the IBF Cruiserweight title. That's going to be an interesting one. Ben Whitaker. For those of you who don't know, Ben Whitaker is maybe one of the funniest and most intriguingly exciting prospects coming out of the Olympics, not these Olympics, but the 2020 Olympics. He is a guy that, you know, physically he's fantastic, but he's a huge showboater inside the ring. Like, actually, I think you would get a kick out of it. if you look at Ben Whitaker's highlights on YouTube, where he's just, you know, he's just dancing around the ring, just making complete fools out of his of overmatched opponents. So that's going to be October 12th in Saudi Arabia. That whole weekend's actually going to be really good because the day after on ESPN Plus, you actually have Naoya Inoue's brother, Takuma Inoue, fighting defending his bantamweight world title. One of the titles that Naonya gave up to move up to super bantamweight. Japanese boxing is really salivating over the fights that 2025 can offer between Takuma and Naoya and Junto Nakatani. I mean, those fights are going to, I mean, there's a lot of mega fights in Japan that's going to happen that are going to be really good. You got Tim Tszyu coming back in on Amazon Prime. I don't remember if that one's going to, I think that fight is going to be like, it's a non-pay-per-view. Thank goodness we're finally getting a PBC Prime video card that's actually not pay-per-view against Bakram Murtasalia, but I think that fight's taking place in Australia. So let's see what else. I mean, I have like a big schedule right here. I'm not going to go for every single fight, but just the, I guess, the big ones. Of course, I'm going to say it not because I think it's a big fight, but I know people are going to be interested in watching it. Jake Paul, Mike Tyson.
Yeah, that is, what is that, November 15th?
Yep. I'm really more interested in the undercard. Katie Taylor versus Amanda Serrano. The long-awaited rematch for the undisputed 140-pound title. First fight was unbelievable. It was fantastic. It exceeded expectations. This is still the best fight in women's boxing today. Mario Barrios, who has been on a roll. They actually very recently announced he's going to be defending his WBC welterweight title on that undercard. He's going to be in it too. And there's the Gilberto Ramirez, Chris Bellman-Smith fight that I was just mentioning. That's on November 16th. And you got Usyk versus Tyson Fury. That's going to be December 21. Could be very well be on the same weekend or potentially same day as Gervonta Davis. There's still no news on the Gervonta Davis as far as like anything official. But December 21 is a potential date being thrown around. I think we're maybe at the point where November 2nd, as originally planned or hoped, that's kind of out the window. So now you're looking at like at least, I think, mid to late November for Gervonta Davis's return. Right now, at this point, it could look like Lamont Roach, who's a title holder, 130 pounds. He'd basically be moving up in weight to fight Gervonta Davis. I would assume either 135 or maybe do it like at a 137 or 138-pound catch. Well, actually, no. The last fight Gervonta Davis had was at 135 pounds. No, you can easily do that 135 pounds. So yeah, those two fights could very well be on the very same day. And then Christmas Eve, I'm not kidding, Christmas Eve, you had Naoya Inoue back in the ring. At least that's the plan. The fight has not been announced as far as an opponent, but that is the plan, is basically have Naoya fight essentially Christmas week. And then the end of the year, you have the traditional New Year's Eve mega boxing card that Japan always likes to hold, that, you know, it, for MMA fans, you know, the same day as the Ryzen Super Show that they was sometimes held, that they both, it's one of those instances where like, oh, hey, like the Canelo fight and the UFC at the Sphere fight, where you have two mega fights essentially so close to each other on the same day happening at the same time. That's essentially it. It's like you have Ryzen and then you have whatever big fight in Japan that you have cooking up on December 31st. That one is Fernando Martinez versus Kazuto Ioka. That's a really, really good fight. Their first fight actually took place earlier this year. That's a really good one. So I'm willing to bet there might be a chance like ESPN Plus picks it up at this point, maybe.
And Floyd's not going to do another exhibition where he's able to change the referee in the middle of the fight, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't know. Maybe we can get it. I don't know. What'd be boxing's equivalent of like Earl and Dave Hebner?
How much money does Floyd actually make for those exhibitions? Because I actually see very little people watching that stuff, but somebody's got to watch if they're paying him all this money. But like, I don't see anybody really in my circles paying attention to any of that stuff.
I mean, I don't. I mean, these are just gimmick fights that no one really cares about. I mean, he had the thing with very recently with John Gotti, which no one cared about. I mean, no one cared about the first fight.
Oh, the only thing I saw from that is when he ordered the referee to leave and they brought in a new. That's the only thing I saw from the entire thing.
Yeah, and it's like, I mean, listen, if Floyd can get a bag doing these, you know, sure, whatever, more power to him. But like, no one really. I'm really interested. Like, I don't know how much money he made. I can't imagine he's doing this for less than eight figures. I can't imagine he's got to be doing that for less than eight figures. But the question is, where are you getting those eight figures? You're not going to get that from a live gauge. You're not going to get them from pay-per-view. No chance in hell.
Mm-mm. No, not at all. Just going back to the Netflix thing real quick, because we were talking about the business of boxing at the beginning of the show. The Netflix thing intrigues me because if Netflix wanted to be a player, they would also change the economics of boxing. If Netflix saw that boxing fans added subscriptions for them or helped with churn, though Netflix doesn't have a great churn. They actually keep most of their subscribers. I would be interested in seeing if, you know, whomever, whatever promoter gets in into bed with them, because they are true. Boxing is an international sport. Boxing is one of the most international sports. And Netflix is really the only streaming service that is, you know, truly, truly international with how many countries they're in. And I started to wonder if they were interested, because they are so global, it might make some sense to work with a promoter. I mean, you only have the one price point. You can come in. They could help with their ads business, which is the thing that they are trying to grow. Just the one thing that they're not actually good at right now is they're not good at getting subscribers to take on their ad tier. That intrigues me. But by the looks of the first fight that they picked up, they believe that the freak fight is going to be the thing that could possibly draw them some eyeballs. But I do wonder, like, I don't think Jake Paul is the person to get into bed with if you're Netflix. Like, Jake Paul there's not many of these Jake Paul fights left, as far as I can tell. Like, and who really gives a crap if he fights a YouTuber again? That's such a small niche of a niche when it comes to the name value of those folks. But if could you put, like what if Canelo's like, yeah, the Saudi Arabia stuff, great. I actually want to go to Netflix, and I want my next fight. I'll fight whomever, Terrence Crawford, and it's going to be on Netflix, and that is going to be the event. I think that would be a really big thing, because of that Netflix is over 200 and some odd million subscribers these days. You could not reach more people for a single boxing match, I think, than if you just put it on Netflix.
And the thing about it is that there are so many, I mean, boxing in the last like 10 years or so has now become a truly global sport, in the sense that we can see fights from virtually anywhere now. It's no longer a whatever, you know, if some TV station picks up a fight from outside. We're no longer in the era of like HBO barely picking like only a couple of fights from the UK a year to broadcast.
And then show it on delay because they show it for their audience. Yeah.
Yeah. Like the way in the old days, for those of you who don't know, like the olden days, they would air a fight on tape delay. The way they would do it is they would essentially start a broadcast, sometimes maybe a little bit earlier, show that fight, and then go into the actual fights that they have brought in. At that point, it just becomes like they only do two fights live and then just do the third one like as a bonus thing. Like, that's kind of like, that was the olden days. And I say olden days, it was like what, 15 years ago, like basically they were doing that. Like, yeah, the only times they would do that is like barely, like mostly when Klitschko fought in Europe, like when, you know, they would have either whenever Vitaly or Vladimir would fight, they would sometimes they would air it live, but the focus is just to air it on tape delay, like a few hours later.
I think the Joshua Klitschko fight we were talking about, I think they showed it twice. They showed the live version, and then they showed it again in their primetime slot.
Yes,
no one will do that anymore. Unless somehow broadcast television gets back into the boxing game, which I'd be surprised, though. They got back in with WWE, so it could happen.
And also, with a lot of these different countries, like for example, like Japan is still to a certain extent somewhat of an untapped market in terms of international broadcasting, because there are some fantastic fights, and I don't think it would take a ton of money to buy to get those international rights. I mean, outside from stuff, you know, where Naoya's Japanese promoter Akihiko Honda, I mean, you know, aside from obviously they're in bed with ESPN Plus, obviously not those fights, but like outside from that, there's still a lot of really good fights that you don't necessarily have to spend a whole ton of money on. Like a lot of these promoters in these other countries, they don't really focus a whole lot on broadcasting rights beyond their country, so you can relatively get it for for cheap. And I think that's, you know, something you can do, where because Netflix is such a global platform, more so than any other streaming platform on the planet, is that you can start building up, you can start doing small tests where, like, you have fights from Japan or from a lot of these different countries, and just sort of kind of test the waters a little bit. Amazon Prime in Japan, that's what they're doing. They're doing fights now on Amazon Prime in Japan, where they're picking up, like, not club shows, but not like the Naoya Inoue super shows. I mean, I think they still do that. They still do Naoya Inoue fight, but they do like a little bit more beyond like the smaller shows. And Canelo, I mean, Canelo has technically is a promoter because he does promote some cards, or at least his name is attached to some of these cards. So that's something where, like, Netflix can come in, get Canelo to not just be on board, but also, you know, have, you know, showcase some fights in Mexico where his, you know, they put his name on it. You start to build up something. That's what Canelo did when he first signed, I think it was the second contract with DAZN. That's essentially what happened, is that he essentially created his own promotional company, and they just started doing like club level shows in Mexico as a condition for Canelo to fight on their platform, or at least one of the conditions.
All right. I think we did a good job of catching back up here with boxing, and, you know, we're doing more writing on Fight Game Media. So I want to do more boxing stuff, because it just gives me a chance to catch back up. We've been so pro wrestling focused on the website. So this opportunity, when I get a chance to talk to you about boxing, it's awesome. So I want to thank Carlos for jumping on. Carlos, tell people where they can find you on Twitter and on Twitch and anywhere else.
So you can find me on Twitter at Carlos Toro Media. You can also find me on Twitter, but they're really more of a gaming type of deal, but I'll just play it anyway. Toro 9360, that's TORONITE. Also same name on Twitch, Toro 9360. I mainly on Twitch is basically do speed runs of video games. One thing I will say, I am possibly thinking about just trying out the Undisputed game. Boxing game. Actually, I was in PAX West in Seattle a couple of weeks ago, and I did actually get my chance to get a first hands on try at the game. The game, I think you can get it, still technically in development, but you can play it. And, you know, I will say, after it took me a little bit of a while to get used to the controls, it's slightly different than what, you know, than past boxing video games, but it did feel good. I actually play as Arturo Gatti in the one fight that I did. I ended up winning, and I think it was like in the second or third round, and it was fun. It's definitely a fun game that's right now currently being funded by Saudi Arabia.
I was wondering where the money was coming from, because they're licensing tons of fighters, and like you said, it's just been in development forever. I haven't seen an actual release date. I don't know if it's coming to consoles or if it's just a PC game. Like, I have no idea. This game has been coming out for like 3 years now, it seems.
It's definitely been in development way longer than that. So it's funny because I actually, you know, I did, like, I think it was like an hour long interview with one of the developers, like right at the start of the pandemic, right before, but it's currently being called Undisputed. That was not the original name. The original name when it was in early development was Esports Boxing Club.
Yes.
And they were, you know, they still had a lot of, and the Saudi money coming in, that was like this year. That was like this year that was made official. And I think part of the problem was definitely that it was very slow. I mean, they were getting names. They were getting, they were telling me, even like off the record, they were telling me like, oh man, we got some names. We had some legends that we're going to put in. I think they eventually got announced, but it was a very slow roll. And I think the pandemic didn't help. And I think the funds were, I'm not trying to speculate here, but like a game like this with so many different fighters, obviously that's going to cost money. So having Saudi Arabia come in and just essentially fund almost the whole thing, I mean, that's definitely going to help. And I don't know if there's a release date. I mean, I've had release dates thrown at me for years, and
you know, obviously all of them have gone and passed. I think right now it's scheduled to be released in the coming weeks. I think that that's the current plan. Like it's being for modern consoles, for PlayStation 5, which I don't have. Xbox Series, the Xbox console, I don't have. So I'm just hoping that my laptop, that this gaming specified laptop is good enough to handle Undisputed. That's my hope. I tried it on, I tried it on an Xbox. It felt great. Once you kind of got a handle of the controls, it felt great. But the, but that's definitely something that, you know, once it's out, then once I'm confident, like, okay, my laptop will not explode.
Here's what I have. And I just looked it up because you mentioned release date. And I was like, oh, I wonder if there is one. So
there is
the PS5 edition. It looks like November 11th is the release date.
That's interesting because I think
October. 11th. October. 11th.
Okay, I was about to say I'm seeing October 11th.
Yes, you can order it in two versions, the normal standard version for $60, and then for $80 you get fighter pack, apparel pack, the era pack, which might be the legends that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And then you can play it early. So Canelo is on the cover of the regular one, and this is US because it looks like there's a bunch of different geographies. And then Tyson Fury is on the deluxe version, the deluxe WBC edition is what it's called.
Yep, that one's interesting because the WBC actually was putting out support for that game like right almost from the very beginning. And I remember there were plans for like there to be, you know, at big fights when, you know, and I'm talking like at a Tyson Fury, Deontay Wilder fight where like the WBC world title would be on the line at the main event. And not many people know about this. So, because it wasn't public at the time. But the idea was to have like tournaments and have like matches of people playing the video game where the winner would be like given an actual legitimate WBC world title, like to be called like the undisputed like esports boxing club world champion. That was their plan, to try to have you know, at these WBC world title fights, just to have the video game also be alongside it.
That's interesting. I think they definitely have their work cut out for them because there hasn't been a boxing game in a while, but maybe that works to their advantage. I bought the WWE game earlier this year, and I literally played it like two times, and I haven't played it since. And it's not because it's bad; it's just because I play two games. I play MLB The Show, and I play NBA 2K, and I play NBA 2K with my sons because you can jump online and run 5-on-5 against other crews. And the show is really just, you know, it's a singular game for me. I don't normally play with others, but I also picked up NCAA college football, which is back after 10 years.
God, I wish I could buy that. I wish I had a PS5. I really wanted it.
It's not perfect, but if you, again, jumping online with some friends, you can take a school and compete and rebuild the school, essentially. Like, we all took teams that were very low rated and were trying to rebuild programs. And
mine was Central Michigan.
I'm Southern Florida, so USF is my team. But my buddy's taken Reno. My other buddy's taken Coastal Carolina. They were all like low rated schools, and were actually in our third season, we were all in the top 20. And then two of us actually made it out of the tournament for the playoff, and they're facing each other in the championship game. So it only took us 3 years, but you're playing a lot, but that aspect of it is fun. The game itself, it plays very similarly to how it used to play on the PS4. So there are some problems with it, but overall, I think it's worth it. I think a lot of people are having a blast with it. But anyway, it's very hard to break into my cadence of games, because I kind of play them very specifically and when I have the time and when I'm not doing other stuff. So I don't imagine I'm going to buy Undisputed, but heck, you know, if it is like a must-have game, you know, it's probably worth trying out, because I don't know, what's the last boxing game I really played? What was the EA Sports one? Knockout Kings?
Or whatever. Knockout Kings would eventually turn into Fight Night.
Fight Night. That's what it was. Fight Night.
Knockout Kings was like 2000. Like, I think their latest one was like 2002, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Was funny enough. That was actually the very first boxing video game I ever had. I had Knockout Kings 2000 on the PlayStation 1 and the Game Boy Color. The PS1 version I thought was really, really good, because like it had a mode where like you get to relive classic fights, and you got to like, they had like a whole little, like had an essay on like the build up to the fight, mm-hmm. and the concept, which is like fantastic. And the cool thing is you get to fight as Mills Lane in this referee.
Yeah, and EA has had the UFC license now for several years, and they're releasing that game every year, but no one had picked up. I don't even know what a boxing license is. It's not like there's a league. So I don't know even who you're licensing, unless it's just directly with the fighters or with the promoters. But yeah, so I mean, if it's good, I'm hopeful it's really good, so that more boxing games get created, and then the boxers, you know, get a little piece of the action. But all right. That's going to be it from here. I want to thank again Carlos Toro for joining up, and we'll figure out a time when to come back and have another discussion. But this has been a lot of fun, and so for Carlos Toro, I am Double G. We will see you when we see you. Peace out.
Question for you. Would you rather pay $150 a month or $15 a month to work out with the same high-quality gym equipment? At Planet Fitness, you can get top-tier equipment for $15 a month. Plus, save $28 or more when you join now during our Strong Choice Sale. Our weights weigh the same, you just don't pay the same. Enjoy free fitness training and 24-hour access at most clubs, all in the judgment-free zone. Join Planet Fitness today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month, cancel anytime. Deal ends October 10th. See club for details.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger. For thousands of appetizing ingredients that inspire countless mouthwatering meals. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week, and up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with points. So you can get big flavors and big savings. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.